On this week's 51%, our associate producer Jody Cowan speaks with director Jessica Paldon about her new film Teardrop on Fire, highlighting the stories of domestic violence survivors in Sri Lanka.
It's toxic patriarchy that we as women and male allies need to step up, take a stand against.
We also speak with David Radley, senior scientist for the Commonwealth Fund, about the organization's 2024 scorecard for women's health care in the U.S. I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on. I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it. I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Jesse King. Today we're talking everything from women's health care to child care to survivorship. Our first guest is Jessica Paldon, a French teacher turned director from New York's Capital Region. She recently had the debut screening of her first documentary in Troy, New York. It's called Teardrop on Fire and explores the impact of domestic and gender-based violence half a world away in Sri Lanka.
Allies are very, very, very important. As a man, I am an ally for women. And I think all men need to be allies of women.
We need to start thinking about our children. And to think about our children, we need to have our women safe. The future is our women and children.
Without hope.
The film was created with a team of Sri Lankan producers, artists, and activists, and shares the experiences of Sri Lankan women who have experienced domestic violence and those who are helping others survive and escape it. While the film focuses on Sri Lanka, it's certainly not an issue that is unique to Sri Lanka. Women around the world might see themselves in Paldon's subjects. And in fact, Paldon came to the film by way of her own traumatic experience. After surviving abuse from a partner in Sri Lanka, Paldon says directing Teardrop on Fire has been a way for her to empower other women and find her own healing. Our associate producer Jody Cowan spoke with Paldon after the screening to learn more. Just a heads up, this conversation obviously discusses domestic abuse. If that's something that's going to be triggering for you, feel free to come back to us in about 13 minutes.
So I'm a practicing Buddhist in the Vajrayana tradition, and I had gone to India back in 2000 with my gurus, with my teachers originally, and had an amazing experience in the chaos of Mother India. And that's where I met the father of my three kids, and he came to the U.S. with me, and we decided to go back as a family to India to really immerse the kids in Tibetan language and culture and the religion and spirituality. We were up in Dharamsala in Himachal Pradesh. We were at the feet of His Holiness the Dalai Lama on like a monthly basis, getting teachings directly from him in Tibetan. We were all taking Tibetan classes, learning how to read and write. And it was a really transformative year. But during that visit, we had to go on a visa run every 6 months when you're living in India on visa. As a foreigner, you have to make a visa run. So we chose to go to Sri Lanka. It's somewhere we'd never been to before, and a lot of friends in Dharamsala were saying, oh, Sri Lanka is this amazing place, just opened up to tourism recently, the civil war's ended, it's safe to travel there now. It's absolutely amazing, your children will love it, the landscape, the wildlife. So I booked an Airbnb, and we flew to Sri Lanka, and we did a lot of Buddhist pilgrimage there. We visited a lot of the beautiful temples, stupas. It's an island filled with dharma and tradition and culture of the Buddhist lineage. And I fell in love with Sri Lanka on that trip. And I actually went back several times during the year we were living in India. And I decided to go into business with a Sri Lankan man who I met on my first trip there. And we bought land together. This all transpired very, very quickly. Within a year, I owned beachfront property in Sri Lanka, and it was my intention to live on the beach with the three kids and homeschool them and pick coconuts from the tree and eat mangoes and surf and do yoga and meditate and live the life, the dream life. But quickly that dream turned into a nightmare, and this is actually the backstory for my making of the film. it turns out that my Sri Lankan partner it committed what is called love fraud. This is something that happens to women all over the world, but a lot in South Asia. There are these local men who fall in love fraudulently with foreign women, and it's their intention to get them to invest in land and property and build up a business. And then once everything is set, they beat the heck out of these women. So I had no idea that this existed. I believed that his intentions were pure. I fell for it, hook, line, and sinker, you know, and he caught me. And I was very naive. I made a lot of bad decisions looking back. But, you know, as a spiritual practitioner, you know, I have to extend grace not just to others, but to myself as well. So this film became a vehicle for me to reach out to not just foreign women that had been abused, but to the local community in Sri Lanka who saved me, really. The women of Sri Lanka saved me. There are women who run shelters and NGOs and organizations because there's no official governmental infrastructure to help abused women and children in Sri Lanka. It's all done by private organizations. So the film became a way for me to embody my healing spiritual journey and to celebrate all of the people that I met in the community who helped me back up on my feet and who are helping others. And I wanted to give them a platform to tell their story. So it's not just victims and survivors of abuse that are featured in the film, but it's also the allies and the advocates that are so important in the healing process.
And just tell me some more about what can viewers expect with your film, Teardrop on Fire?
They can expect firsthand to have an experience of what it's like to be in a toxic relationship. So obviously I made it for people who are trauma survivors, who are victims and survivors of abuse, but I also made it for the greater community to understand abuse because we've all been affected by it one way or another, even if we haven't personally been a victim. We know somebody who has, and we all experience generational trauma in one way, shape, or form, whether we're a perpetrator because we experienced it and now we're just repeating the cycle, or if we're a victim, or if we have a family member or friend that's been a victim and or perpetrator. You know, people can be victims and perpetrators at the same time. It's so interwoven and ingrained in our society and normalized. It's very normalized abuse. I mean, even on the macro level, I'm talking about it on like intimate partner level right now, but on the macro level, you know, what is Trump doing? What are the Rajapakshas doing? It's toxic patriarchy that we as women and male allies need to step up and take a stand against. And there is so much shame. And this film, I guess another major point of it is to dismantle the shame around abuse and empower people to talk about it, empower men, women, and children to talk about it, because we're silenced and by shame to not speak about it because of all the victim blaming. And if somebody comes up and speaks out about their abuse, they're immediately asked, well, why'd you stay? Or why'd you go back? We need to reframe that question and ask, well, why, as we as society, are we raising individuals to be abusive?
And finding the women, the men, the survivors that were interviewed for the film, if you could speak to the building of that trust in communicating, you know, their story.
So we started finding our subjects or participants with an open call in Colombo, the capital city. And we had a few people come out, and then we, through my networking and community of shelters and allies and advocates and organizations, we went out on a tour throughout the island, and word spread. It's a small island, and people learned about the project pretty fast, and I didn't have to have any more open calls after that initial one. People were contacting me and say, how can I be a part of this? So I always met with my subjects pre-shoot to establish the trust, to tell them my backstory, to tell them, you know, I too am a survivor. I know what you've been through. You're in a safe space. you're not going to be judged. And I always gave them a choice of anonymity when they signed their consent forms. You know, do you want to be anonymous? Do you want to be backlit? Do you want to show who you are? So it was always them in the driver's seat making their choices. And we did have, after post-production was done, I had several subjects reach out to me and say, you need to take me out of the film now. I returned to my abuser. It's important to note that on average, abused women return to that relationship 7 times before they finally leave. And so I knew that was a risk because I think I returned to my abuser like 21 times. I kind of lost count because that toxic addiction is so intense. And to leave, a woman has to really leave everything. In my case, I had to leave $100,000 on the table. That's what I invested in the property. I'll never see that money again. And women in Sri Lanka, women and children in Sri Lanka, have to leave their village, have to leave everyone that they know with maybe no prior education, no job skills. And I have a master's degree. I have a passport. I was able to get in on a plane and leave and restart my life pretty easily once I did my healing and my therapy. But the majority of women and children in Sri Lanka and in these developing countries don't have those. And the courage it takes to be ostracized by their entire village, to be shamed by their entire village, still come out, tell their story, and leave and restart their lives, it's amazing. I mean, they are real superheroes.
In watching the film, I was really struck by the almost juxtaposition of the beauty in the cinematography and the like, the landscape that was there, and then just the, you know, the heartbreaking stories and the intensity, the urgency of the stories that are being told of the victims of abuse there. And I was kind of curious if this was something that was just, as far as the tone of that, was that just indicative of being in Sri Lanka itself?
It was very intentional. I'm so glad that you pointed that out, because that was a directorial choice. That was very intentional. I wanted people to experience that dichotomy, that contradiction, that paradox of, it's a paradise. It's the Paradise Island. It's the original Garden of Eden. It is, you know, the pearl of the Indian Ocean. It is Spice Island. It is so immensely beautiful there. And yet there's an underside that a lot of tourists, foreigners, will never know about. And I set out to expose that. But I also wanted to give the viewers a break from the intensities of these stories and the suffering. There's a lot of suffering in this film, especially in the first half. And I wanted to give the audience a break and some meditation time to kind of decompress after, in between each story. So it's woven together like a collage intentionally that way. But I also wanted it to be symbolic of that toxic cycle of abuse, how they're the highs and the lows, the beauty and the pain, and that's what you get stuck in. So we did 2 blocks of shoots. The first block focuses on that first half, the backstories of the victims and survivors. And it originally was a 30-minute film, which I then pitched to Sundance to get further funding. I was rejected by Sundance, and I said, well, I guess I have to take it into my own hands. And I did crowdsourcing, and I raised enough money to go back a year later. And I'm really glad it happened that way, because then I got to follow up with subjects and see the trajectory of their lives, what their story arc was, where they were in a year, lost some subjects along the way, found some new ones. And then after having these 2 blocks of shoots within a 2-year time with over 3 TB of footage, amazing B-roll of the environment, you know, I had to go comb through all this and decide, okay, how am I going to structure it? How am I going to do this? I already had the 30-minute first part, and I knew that's the backstory, the darkness, the heaviness, the trauma. And then I wanted the second half to be the healing, people coming out on the other side, seeing the light at the end of the tunnel and blossoming. So it kind of embodied my healing process, really. Even though my story is not in the film, every single one of the segments and subjects touch on something that I personally experienced. So I feel like my story is told through this film.
Overall, what do you hope to leave people with in experiencing this film?
Hope and a sense of honor of the sacred feminine and the resilience of women and men and children who overcome the toxic cycle of abuse and as I said earlier, to dismantle the shame around talking about such subjects. If anybody's listening and inspired about the film, you can find us at teardroponfiredoc.com, and you can email me at teardroponfiredoc@gmail.com. I'd be very open to bringing the film and healing session to your community.
Jessica, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your film with us all.
Well, thank you, Jody. It was a pleasure being here. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
That was Jessica Paladin, director of the documentary Teardrop on Fire, speaking with our associate producer, Jody Cowan. If you or someone you love is struggling with domestic violence, know you're not alone, and help is available at the National Domestic Violence Hotline. You can text START to 88788, call 1-800-799-SAFE, or chat online at thehotline.org. A little closer to home now. Here in New York, Governor Kathy Hochul is touting a state investment meant to expand access to childcare. WAMC's Samantha Simmons brings us more.
Hochul often points out that she's the first mother to ever serve as New York governor. Many families across the state are struggling to afford childcare amid an affordability crisis. Speaking in Albany, Hochul says the average cost of childcare for a family of four in the state is more than $21,000 for infants. Hochul cheered a $1.8 billion investment in the state budget for the Child Care Accessibility Program, an online portal meant to make it easier for families to enroll children in free or low-cost child care.
This new online platform allows families to check their eligibility, apply for assistance, and find child care providers to fit their needs without having to take the time and go through mountains of paperwork as had been the case in the past. The entire process takes about 10 minutes from start to finish.
Hochul says if families have to choose between childcare and groceries, the economy suffers.
When childcare is scarce, businesses struggle to recruit and retrain qualified workers. If they're at risk of losing workers or think they won't find them, they'll just go somewhere else. That's a challenge we must overcome. If New York wants to remain competitive, if we want our businesses and our families to thrive, we have to tackle this challenge head on.
The governor says the program will cover up to 90% of costs for those earning up to 85% of the state's median income of just over $105,000 for a family of four. Hochul says the state is working to provide subsidies to facilities to ensure they can expand programs and hire and retain employees. Hochul says she understands firsthand the stress of ensuring children have a safe and affordable place to go during the work week.
Just like I did 35 years ago, parents today are sitting at the table trying to figure out, do the math, how they're going to afford their family's basic needs, and let alone save for the future education costs for their children. For too many families, it just doesn't add up. And guess what? New York is losing young families as a result. They're moving away, looking for more affordable places where they can find a home.
Last year, Hochul expanded the child care tax credit to include children under four. U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, a fellow Democrat, says access to child care is vital to development.
Child care is essential not just for parents to be in the workplace, but for the children themselves to develop emotionally, to develop intellectually, to develop social skills so they can navigate young play and other kids at an early age. It's actually fundamentally important for their development.
Gillibrand says she is working on a number of bills aimed at providing federal funding to address the child care crisis in the aftermath of the pandemic.
Because families couldn't bring their children to daycare, a lot of daycare centers closed. So pre-pandemic, there was one slot for every four kids. In the middle of the pandemic, there was one slot for every eight kids. So there became a huge challenge. And so post-COVID, we agreed that we had to surge resources to these childcare centers so they could reopen, so they could actually afford to be open to increase those slots.
Aisha Jeter, a mother of three, says during the pandemic, she was able to work from home, mitigating the need for full-time daycare. But when she was mandated to report back to the office, finding care was daunting. She says using the state's program, she was able to unlock hundreds of dollars in savings a month.
I know firsthand that this new online portal is going to be a game changer for working families. Working families who can now access benefits and enrollment information without the headaches of navigating, having to make phone calls, emails, appointments. Very difficult when you're working full-time raising kids.
Gillibrand says with more than 1.3 million children under the age of 5 in the state, nearly two-thirds of families live in child care deserts, a majority of whom are in rural areas of the state. And she says the federal government must make investments so parents can work, earn money, and pay into the social safety net. Samantha Simmons, WAMC News, Albany.
Thank you, Sam. Lastly, the Commonwealth Fund, a foundation promoting research on healthcare issues, is out with a new report examining the state of healthcare for women across the U.S. The 2024 State Scorecard on Women's Health and Reproductive Care looks at how reproductive care has changed since the overturning of Roe v. Wade, but also how women are faring in other aspects of their health, like their mental health, cancer screenings, and their ability to find a primary care doctor. Each state was given a score based on its own performance. For a rundown on the top performing states, I spoke with senior scientist David Radley.
So this particular report looked at 32 measures total, but we grouped those measures into three areas. We call them domains in the report, but we look at several measures of healthcare outcomes. So this would be, you know, measures like mortality or like all-cause mortality or mortality from breast and cervical cancer. And other kinds of things that you'd think of as being sort of health outcomes. Then we look at several measures related to healthcare access. So women's ability to access care when she needs it. That domain would have measures like insurance coverage, some measures that look at affordability of care and structural measures related to, you know, healthcare workforce supply. And then finally, we look at a domain that's made up of quality measures. These are more like some of the technical measures of quality. And this would include measures like the rate at which women are getting, you know, recommended cancer screenings, postpartum care, for example. So that dimension is made up mostly of the more technical quality measures.
And so what did you find? You know, which states performed the best on this scorecard and which states have some stuff to work on?
Yeah. So our overall rankings, you know, we took a look, Vermont, Rhode Island, Connecticut, New Hampshire sort of round out the top five. And I think what top performing states really have in common is that they have really done a lot to make sure that as many people, particularly as many women as possible in the state, have access to healthcare, make sure that they have insurance coverage. They've all expanded their Medicaid programs to make sure that healthcare coverage is available to low-income people in the state. And they've worked to make sure that reproductive health services are accessible and legal. And those are some of the things that really, you know, help those states stand out as top performers. The sort of the other end of the spectrum, you know, Arkansas, Nevada, Oklahoma, Texas, Mississippi, those are the states sort of at the bottom of the rankings this year. You know, again, in each of those states, healthcare access is a real issue. It's a real challenge. These are states that haven't expanded their Medicaid programs. You know, not having coverage really is one of the largest barriers for women looking for different kinds of healthcare.
When it comes to coverage and affordability, what are you noticing as some of the biggest barriers, I guess, to that?
There's a lot of ways that people sort of fall through the cracks. Maybe they have employer-sponsored insurance, but it just doesn't offer very much protection, and they still have real affordability concerns. We were looking at the share of women 18 to 44 who said that they needed care in the last year but couldn't afford to go. They had to skip the care that they felt like they needed because it was too expensive. You know, nationally, about 1 in 5 women said that they skipped and needed care because of cost in the last year. That, you know, of course, that varies between states. I'm taking a look at the New York data here, and in New York, it was 1 in 7. So a little bit better than average, but still 14% of women saying that they couldn't get care in the last year that they felt like they needed simply because they couldn't afford it. In other cases, you know, maybe somebody just doesn't qualify for Medicaid and they don't have insurance through their job, in which case they'll be part of the group that are uninsured. In most states, undocumented people are not eligible for Medicaid. That's a big problem, particularly in states along the border.
Well, specifically looking at New York, you know, where this show is based, how did New York fare? And I guess what does it have going for it? But maybe what are some other things that it also has to work on?
First of all, New York did pretty well overall in this report. New York ranked 10th overall. What did New York have going for it? I mean, New York is a big, diverse state that has really prioritized, you know, healthcare and coverage. New York was an early expansion state, and that sort of comes through in the data. New York has one of the lowest uninsured rates in the country, and certainly for a large state, it's one of the lowest. We also know, though, that insurance coverage alone, you know, it's necessary, but it's not sufficient. It's just one piece of sort of the healthcare access equation. The other piece of the access equation is having doctors that, you know, or healthcare providers that you can actually go see when you need to. And that's, I think, an area where New York has some work to do, particularly in some of the more rural parts of the state. Almost every state has workforce issues, and those workforce issues are compounded in places that are rural. One of the ways that we sort of track, you know, the sort of other side of this access equation is how often people say that they have a usual source of care. In New York, 21% of women aged 18 to 44 said that they didn't have a usual source of care. You know, when you don't have a regular doctor, somebody who you think of as sort of being that gateway to the rest of the delivery system, you know, has implications. It has implications for being able to manage chronic illness, has implications for trying to get important disease screenings. And it may end up, you know, if you don't have sort of a primary care doc who you can call for relatively small things, you may end up, you know, getting routine care in an emergency department, which isn't very efficient. It's much more expensive than getting care through a primary care provider. Sort of the pieces of this system sort of, you know, compound on one another. One of the other sort of measures of access that we look at is the share of women who reported having sort of a routine visit in the last 2 years. New York ranks 12 out of 51. 11% of women age 18 to 44 in the state said that they didn't have a routine checkup in the last 2 years. That's not bad nationally, but it still, I think, represents an area where we can improve. Because I live in New York and I sort of understand the healthcare markets, especially in upstate New York, I know that getting access to like a primary care doc can be challenging. You might try to make an appointment with the person you think of as being your primary care doc, and it might take 6 months or 8 months to get in for just a routine appointment. And New York could do things to incentivize more primary care docs to sort of come into the workforce. You know, we need to enhance the supply of primary care providers in the state.
Well, lastly, you know, I'd like to ask you about a topic we've touched on a couple times on this show, which is maternal mortality. Are there states where you found the maternal mortality rate to be worse than others?
Yeah, you know, maternal mortality has been something that's been in the news a lot lately. We know that in the U.S., maternal mortality rates are higher than they are in other high-income countries. And when we look across the country, there's huge variation across states. States in the Southeast, particularly, you know, sort of in the Mississippi Delta region, they tended to have the highest rates of maternal mortality. So these would be deaths that occur either as a direct result of pregnancy or within 42 days of the end of a pregnancy. Why are the rates higher in that part of the country? I mean, there's probably a lot of reasons, a lot of them having to do with access to care. I mean, there are some very rural parts of the country down there, sort of places that are acknowledged maternal care deserts. There's deep-seated socioeconomic disparities in some of those parts of the country. And I think those things are definitely having an impact.
David Radley is a senior scientist for the Commonwealth Fund's Tracking Health System Performance Initiative. You can find the organization's full 2024 state scorecard on women's health and reproductive care and see how your state ranks at commonwealthfund.org. Thanks to you for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producers are Jody Cowan and Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King for 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. lost my cool somewhere along the way. A nightmare down the hallway. I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool.